Hi, I'm Kathleen Dunn, and you are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Thursday, the 21st of October. We are broadcasting live from the Milwaukee Art Museum, one of the most beautiful buildings that's been constructed in the last 100 years in this country. Nancy Pearl is joining us in our studio. Yeah, Nancy. You have many fans here in Milwaukee. And we're so happy. We've had a chance to do a couple live interviews with Nancy, but we're here to talk about, but usually I just have her action figure as I talk next to my microphone. She has an action figure, if you haven't seen that. It's kind of cool. Her latest book, she has the whole series, as you know, Book Lust, and the latest one has just come out very recently. It's Book Lust to Go. And it is recommended reading for travelers, vagabonds, and dreamers. She is here to talk about books, not only this book, but all kinds of books. We kind of balance each other because, well, she reads and remembers everything. I read and don't remember everything. But I tend to read a whole lot of nonfiction for this program, and Nancy reads everything, as I'm sure you do as well. So if you need book recommendations, if you want to talk about a fabulous book that you read, please, these are our microphones, and we'll give preference to our audience here in Milwaukee. But we do have a phone number you can use, 800-486-8655. Hello, Nancy.
Hello, Kathleen. It's so wonderful to be here again.
Do you love this building?
Oh, my gosh. I love this building. We got a little peek into the gift shop. I already told my husband that there are two things that I wanted to get. He was not so thrilled about one of them, but I didn't show him the other one yet. We'll have to see what happens.
Yes. Oh, good. We can go there later.
And I mean, it's a beautiful building.
Isn't it?
Yes.
Isn't it just spectacular?
And listening to Lori talk, of course, about the Frank Lloyd Wright exhibit coming up, of course, two books popped into my head.
Of course, you're Nancy.
I mean, it's not, it's like a disease. You just hear a topic and then these books come into it. So one is, which many of you I know have read for your book group, if not for other things, Loving Frank by Horan.
Loving Frank.
Yes, and actually she's a Washingtonian as well. And then the other is a novel by T.C. Boyle, B-O-Y-L-E.
Okay.
And I forget the title, but you should be able to find The Women.
The Women.
Okay. The Women, right.
That's new, isn't it?
Is that newish. Newish.
Newish?
Yeah. I think it's probably in paperback now.
Have you done the Taliesin tour here in Wisconsin?
No.
That would be fun for you to spend some time here.
Okay.
And see Taliesin East and go down to Chicago to see some of
We saw that in Oak Park.
Yeah, saw that one.
Yeah.
Isn't that great?
Yes.
I love the room where the sheet music, there's a whole built-in cabinet for sheet music, which I think is great. Well, it's really nice to have you here. I never think about what I wear, but, you know, I told you how you dress so artistically. And Nancy and I, the last time we spoke a couple weeks ago, I said, I don't know, popped in my mind, what are you going to wear? And she told me, I've met people, what are you going to wear? But I like this outfit. You see, me, I don't know how to do it.
You look beautiful.
I don't know how to do it.
Well, I just
lovely give, outfit.
You need to come to visit Seattle so I can take you to my Eileen Fisher store.
Okay, all right.
I just say, this is what I have to do, and they say, this is what you need to get.
I like that kind of shopping. And we have to convince your husband, who I have not had the pleasure of meeting yet, that Nancy needs to move to Milwaukee. Yes, yeah, yep. We'll all welcome you. We'll show you around town, and you can tell us about books, and it's all good. So let's start with Book Lust to Go.
Okay.
We've talked a lot about this. We'll go beyond it. But Nancy, you really do travel a lot, but she says she's a reluctant traveler.
Right. I travel a lot for work, and when I get to a place to do the work, I really love it, but I don't enjoy the anxieties that come along with me when I travel, and I think that a very severe psychiatrist might say agoraphobia is at work here. And so when I was thinking about writing that book, Book Lust to Go, writing a book about armchair travel, about explorers, about novels set in different countries, all of those things. I thought at first, oh, I'm not the right person to do this, because while I've been in many places around the world, I haven't been in every place that I mentioned. I think there's 175 different cities, countries, you know, continents in there. But then I thought, wait a minute, I have been in all those places through reading. And in the truest way, I'm the absolutely best person, all modesty aside at this point. Sorry. I apologize for that. I'm a very good person to write a book, which when you want to go somewhere, one of the questions, some of you may not know, Kathleen knows, I'm a librarian and I was a bookseller. And one of the most popular questions that we used to get was, I'm going to Venice for vacation. What should I read? And they didn't want Frommers. They didn't want Fodors. I mean, that was taken care of. They wanted a book by, a really readable book set in the country, or mm-hmm. by an author from that country, or all of those, everything that goes into that. And so reading this book, this was the hardest book to write for me of the four book list books, because I had included a lot of those armchair travel books in the earlier two books, Book for Adults, Book Lust, and More Book Lust. And I didn't want to repeat anything in here because I thought that wouldn't be fair to the people who bought it to just have the information in all these places. So it meant doing, I would say, a solid 2 years of reading.
Goodness.
Trolling through used bookstores, looking for books that looked interesting to me, going to all the libraries, looking through their 900s or their 790s, which is when the some of the mountain climbing, bicycling things are that I'm so fond of reading.
Yeah. What's wonderful about you, too, is that you just look at everything. I mean, you've got books that you found in those bookshops that you were right. looking at, or things that we should remember that were published 100 years ago.
Yeah, yes.
Which is great.
And I think that my new mission is that it's so bad that so many books are out of print. They go out of print mm-hmm. so quickly. And wonderful novels that never became bestsellers, that had very small print runs, very small publicity budgets from the publishers. And my mission, or my dearest hope, is that we can do, that somebody will do book lust rediscoveries and reprint books from all four of those books.
That's a great idea. So, Nancy, I forgot to give her a formal introduction. I figure we all know her. It's our friend librarian who's come to town. But she had this wonderful idea, which I have highlighted before, of if all Seattle read the same book, and then it, as you know, it just went all over the world, which I thought was a great idea. So I wanted to ask you today, if we were all in this room going to read the same book.
Kathleen, so hard.
Easy thing for you. What should we read?
I think you should read Nathaniel Philbrick's The Last Stand.
The Last Stand.
The Last Stand.
Okay.
Custer, Sitting Bull, and the Battle of the Little Bighorn. And I think that because Philbrick is one of those very readable nonfiction writers. So his books are not weighted down by all that scholarly apparatus. You know that he's done his research, but you know he synthesized it and is telling a story, the truth, but telling a story in his fiction, in his nonfiction. So any of his books, he did a book about the Mayflower, he did a book about a book called Sea of Discovery, which is absolutely wonderful. But this book about Custer and Sitting Bull and that battle when they came face to face is, I think, one of the most iconic events in American history. And those two men are icons, and I think it's very, very hard to be even-handed about that when you're in that situation. And I think he's done a great job in that book, and it's so readable.
Okay. I told you a couple weeks ago that we went to Springfield last year right now, and we're going to Washington, D.C. We'd like for all of you, we don't have room for all of you, we would like for many of you to join us. We're going to have a great trip. We're going to Gettysburg and Mount Vernon, and I haven't been to D.C. since I was in high school, so I'm really looking forward to the group going with us, because people who listen to public radio are pretty smart, and they're involved, and they know their history. So please see Katie. Where's Katie? If you want to join us. There's Katie. If you're interested, I think she probably has material here because we're going during cherry blossom time. But in preparation for trips like that, give us some history. I really like to read a presidential biography as often as possible, or some time in history. How do people? Do you prepare, as we prepare for our trip? What should we read?
Well, I mean, one of the most interesting presidents, I think, was Theodore Roosevelt. And it's very hard to write a dull book about Theodore Roosevelt because he was such an interesting man. But the one I would start with is David McCullough's Morning on Horseback, Mornings on Horseback, which is the young Theodore Roosevelt. Up to the time, it stops when he becomes governor of New York, and his wife dies. He's going to raise his daughter Alice at that time by himself. And, of course, Alice grows up to be the woman who has embroidered on a little pillow on her sofa, "If you don't have something nice to say about anyone, come sit next to me." So that's Alice. That's Alice Roosevelt Longworth. But then there's another really interesting on the other side of Roosevelt's life, not those early years, but those last years after he lost his bid to become president the third time, when he went down the Amazon, and it's called River of Doubt. And
great
I think
book.
You interviewed
it's a great
Candace.
Book.
Yeah, I remember that. And so that's a great book, too. That's wonderful, wonderful adventure. There's a brand new biography, and this is going to take, you're going to have to really, really, really be, you got to set aside a lot of time for this biography, Ron Chernow's biography of Washington.
Okay, we just got that. It's 900 pages.
Yes.
We counted it right.
Yes.
Okay.
And Ron Chernow did a whole series of earlier books about the great financial families, like the Warburgs, which are wonderful, wonderful to read. But this biography of Washington, when I read it, I was struck by how little is known, how little we know. And I was a history major. How little we know about Washington, the first president, besides the obvious chopping down the cherry tree, his false teeth, all of that kind of thing. And Chernow's a really, really wonderful writer. And Gore Vidal's two books. Oh, you have to read these. Gore Vidal's two books, Lincoln.
Yes.
And Burr.
Yes.
And I would start with Burr, because that happened earlier in time, and then read Lincoln. But they're part of his... I mean, Gore Vidal was a wonderful nonfiction writer. Mm-hmm. I guess we would call them fictional biographies. But he did a great job in both those books. And they're the kind of books where you finish them and you feel like you've learned something. I believe... I have a strong belief in the fact that anything you read, you learn something from, whether it's about human relationships or anything like that. But these are books that talk about that period and those men and women who were involved.
Mm-hmm. Great suggestions. I'll do the Washington book, and I did read Vidal again after we got back from Springfield, but I have the Burr book. The Jonathan Alter book on Obama is quite good, too. We just had him on months ago, The Promise, President Obama, Year One. He's a heck of a reporter.
Yes.
It's a flattering look in many ways, but it's very thorough. It's really
good.
It's quite good.
Good.
And I invited Nancy to go to Washington with us, and she said no, she wants to go to Madagascar. So I said, okay, maybe next year we'll go to Madagascar, but how in the world would you prepare for a trip like that, Nancy?
Oh, Madagascar. I don't think I found any books set in Madagascar. I think, you know, I found and read some wonderful books set in Singapore and Malaysia. In Cambodia, there's a wonderful series of mysteries set in Cambodia by Colin Cotterell. The main character is the only coroner in Cambodia. And it's just, I mean, they're great mysteries. And we're so lucky these days that publishers are bringing in, Soho Press has a whole series of books written by people from different countries that they're bringing in and having translated and making available to us. So that I really think that just allows us to get a little further than where we are, like to step out beyond ourselves mm-hmm. into other parts of the world.
That's what I love about you. You step out all the time with what you read. I don't do that as much. I tend to not do that, but I should.
That's because I don't live in Milwaukee, so I can't quite take you in hand.
I read everything you tell me to read, though. I really do. I listen to her. I know many of you do. Let's go to our audience here at the beautiful Milwaukee Art Museum. We're broadcasting live this morning. We have a great audience with us. Thank you so much for coming on down, although it's not hard to do to come down to the Art Museum and listen to Nancy, right, and say it's a treat. I believe we have somebody over here, and you can also call if you'd like. 800-486-8655 is our number, but our mics are here for you in the audience.
Boyd from Milwaukee.
Hi, Boyd.
Hi, good to see you again, Kathleen. Nancy, it's a pleasure to see you in person.
Thank you.
Before I have my topics I'm interested in reading more about, I have one suggestion. If any of you are interested in ancient Rome, I think this is probably the best book I've read all year. It's called A Day in the Life of Ancient Rome by Alberto Angelna. His description, I know this sounds cliche, it takes place during the period of Emperor Trajan, and it focuses mainly on the common folk, but you really do feel like you are there. And you go to the Colosseum, you go to the bathhouse, but you learn about what they ate, their food, how it's very different from modern Italian cooking, and it's one of those books you buy that you don't recycle that, you keep that, and it's a keeper. The two areas. I was in Baltimore a few years ago for Edgar Allan Poe's birthday celebration, and I was totally blown away by it. And I would love to know more about Baltimore during Poe's time, but also around the war between the states. I know there's one book called The Baltimore Plot, which I would like to read. And also the other request is I'd like to learn more about Morocco, just someone from my past who I was very close with was from there.
Well, I have to say, there is a whole section on Baltimore mm-hmm. and a whole section on Morocco in Book Lust to Go.
Can you believe it?
I mean, you hit the big time. But Poe, I don't think there's anything in the Baltimore section that covers that period of Poe, except that there's a wonderful mystery by Laura Lippman, Lippmann, and her detective, Tess Monahan, that's set around a ritual that occurs on Poe's birthday every year in the graveyard where he's buried. So you might want to take a look at Laura Lippman's book on Poe. But the Morocco book, oh my gosh, there is just so much wonderful, wonderful stuff about people who have moved there, from England, say, or kind of expats, or... just when you go outside the city of Tangier, and you go a little bit out where the population is not so dense, and there's one city whose name has now slipped my mind, where they don't allow cows. They don't allow cars. They do allow cows. They don't allow cars. Sort of like Mackinac Island in Michigan. So, take a look at the book and see. I'm sure the library has it.
Thank you so much.
Thanks, Boyd. Libertyville is here.
Yes, and I'm here as a delighted children's librarian, actually, from Glencoe, Illinois. And I'm even a little nervous talking to you because you're kind of my hero.
She's very accessible.
But there's been a lot of flap. There was an article in the New York Times recently about how parents are not having children read picture books anymore. They're taking them right to what we call in the business chapter books. Mm-hmm. And I was wondering, Ms. Pearl, if you could talk a little bit about maybe what picture books might mean to both children and adults, children preparing to read, but also adults going back and learning some important lessons from books like maybe John Muth's Three Questions, if you're familiar with that, or other picture books that have been important to you. And also, if you would just share with us maybe what are your favorite, either contemporary and or classic picture books.
Well, first you have to call me Nancy, because if you say Miss Pearl, then I think about my mother-in-law, so that would be fine. I loved my mother-in-law, but that was fine. You know, that article in the New York Times just created such an uproar among children's books authors and illustrators. And And if it's true, and I have heard that there's a lot of debunking about that, that it isn't true the way the story was presented, then it's sad. And one of the reasons it's sad is that there's so much beauty to be gained from picture books. And it's not only the beauty of the illustrations or the way the text is told, but it's the sense of a parent sharing with a child. And it's that kind of sharing that you don't get normally when you're reading picture books, when you're reading, not picture books, the chapter books. And I think, there's a book called Bubble Trouble by Margaret Mahey, who's probably the best-known New Zealand children's book writer ever. And just her books are so fun to read. And I have three little granddaughters who are 8, 6, and 3. And having them sit next to you and cuddle up to you. And you're just spending that time reading a picture book, looking at the pictures, talking about what's happening in the book. I think that those are unbeatable moments.
Well, and as we broadcast from the art museum here, it's one of the wonderful things they do, so that you look at Jan Leven's exhibit, and then you learn about Rembrandt, and you learn about the history of the time, and it's a whole history that goes with it. So, but it's the Rembrandt that gets you thinking, so you're looking at something profound.
Yes, and I think that pictures can do pictures make or break a picture book. You can have a wonderful text, but you need the right artist to bring the right illustrations to it. And a friend of mine just published a picture book from Knopf, part of Random House, and when I saw, I had read the text, which I thought was fine, but nothing outstanding. I mean, it was interesting and it was fine, but the pictures made it a wonderful, wonderful book. Mm-hmm. And the combination, the way the artist, the picture book artist, can make sense of the text is just pretty remarkable.
Thank you so much. You draw our attention to important issues. We are broadcasting live from the Milwaukee Art Museum. Nancy Pearl is our guest this hour. She is here looking very spiffy. And she has a new book. If you didn't hear our interview with her a couple weeks ago, it's Book Lust to Go, recommended reading for travelers, vagabonds, and dreamers. And she's going to be signing copies of the book as well, because some of you pledged, I know, during this hour a couple weeks ago. Thank goodness that baby is over. But thank you very much. We did very, very well. And thank you for your generosity. So she'll be chatting with you after this show. We welcome the audience to the microphones here, and we also welcome phone calls. The number is 800-486-8655. We'll take a call or two in a moment on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And we're broadcasting live from the Milwaukee Art Museum. We have a lovely crowd here listening to Nancy Pearl, who's here in person. It's a great treat. We'll go to a phone call. Steve in Rice Lake. Hi, Steve. Hello, Steve. Are you there? We're just having phone problems here. Steve.
Oh, hello? Oh.
Yeah, okay. Hey, Steve.
Hi.
Hi. Go ahead, Steve, please.
Yes, my name is Steve. I am a fan of Roberto Bolaño, and I have a question about experience you have with translation, especially from Spanish. Bolaño's writing is sometimes obscure. But I think it's absolutely charming. But I often wonder about the reliability of the translation. And he keeps coming out with more and more books in English. It's really remarkable. But have you ever talked to a person who is literate in Spanish and English and is satisfied with the translation of Bolaño's work?
You know, I have never met anybody who has spoken to me about that. I do know that one of the best translators from Spanish is a woman named Edith Grossman. But I think you bring up kind of a larger issue, which is that when we're reading a book in translation, and sometimes, I know this happens to me, I feel like it's so stilted you know, it's really hard to sort of get into it because there's language that's just not the way we would talk, and then I never know if that's the way the original author intended it, or if that's a fault of the translator. So I tend to rely on translators that I know. Or that I know of, know and or know of. There's a woman named Tina Nunnally, T-I-I-N-A Nunnally, who translates from the Scandinavian languages, and she just did a few years ago a new translation of Kristin Lovgren's Daughter. And for people who tried it years and years and years ago and couldn't, just never could get into it, take a look at Tina's translation. It's just wonderful.
Do you speak other languages?
Well, in high school, I took French, but I was once in Paris, and the taxi driver mumbled something, you know, to me about the amount, and I just didn't understand, and I kept saying, pardon, 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 and finally he said, 7 francs. And that kind of made me a little, you know, like feeling a little inadequate.
The French can do that to you, can't they? Right. Yeah, they can do that. It would be wonderful. I always admire people who can speak 7 or 8 languages. It would be wonderful to be able to read all these books in original, wouldn't it?
It would, and that would be the ideal.
Right.
And I think that for a long time, Americans were really isolated in that we weren't even getting these books even in English from other countries, and still it's very rare, I mean, except the classics like Tolstoy or Dostoevsky or something like that, but the contemporary stuff we weren't getting, or even Anna Karenina, one of the first translators of Tolstoy was a woman named Constance Garnett, and those used to be in the modern library editions, and those are not great translations. Mm. You know, again, they're the kind of translations that we sometimes feel, oh, this is a classic, I have to read it. Mm. And then you get to the book and you think, oh, no. Anyway, there's a new translation. She's been, there's a wonderful new translation of Tolstoy out. So, I'm in my real life, I'm a pathological pessimist, but most of the time when it comes to books and reading, I feel, you know, a little bit of hope.
Good for you. I liked Anna Karenina. I can't remember. I must have had a good translation. I loved that book.
Yeah.
College, it must have been.
Yeah, but I bet it was Constance Garnett. I bet it was.
Don't have a clue, but maybe. Let's talk about Mark Twain. Mark Twain has a new book too, right? Didn't I see something on the news this week that he's released?
Yes.
Well, everybody's dead now, so the book came out. It's his autobiography.
That he waited and waited. Yes.
Yeah.
That he waited and waited to do that. Uh huh. Yeah.
Do you like him?
I do like him. I do. I loved The Innocents Abroad, which I included in Book Less to Go. And I love, well, Huckleberry Finn, I think, is one of the two novels that everybody should read. And the other one is Little Big Man by Thomas Berger.
Hmm.
It was made into a very good film, but the book, like Huck Finn, talks about identity and talks about what it means to be American.
Hmm.
And all of those issues of race and everything that Huckleberry Finn is about, Little Big Man is about as well.
I've never heard you say that. Two books that everybody should read.
I know.
Now I got to read them.
You do.
Oh, okay.
You do.
Okay.
You
I've read Huck Finn, but
yeah.
Not.
Oh, well, good. Then you just have Little Big Man.
Okay. Let's go. Somebody wants to talk about Mark Twain. Let's go to Mike from Viroqua. Hi, Mike.
Hi. How are you doing today?
Fine, Mike. How are you?
I'm doing great. I was actually listening to The Innocents Abroad for the last couple weeks while I drive to and from school. And it's a book, actually, we always had selected audiobooks when I would go on vacation road trips with my parents as a kid. And the passage that we always went to, the book that we had to have every single road trip, was a passage from An Innocents Abroad called Guying the Guides. And we talk about this one particularly obnoxious guide that they had in Spain and all the grief that he would give them.
Well, I did a chapter in a section in Book Lust to Go called It Seemed Like a Good Idea at the Time. and that's the kind of thing. And then there's a book, a fun book about Spain called Everything But the Squeal. And it's about sort of a memoir with recipes, Spanish recipes in it, which I kind of loved too. Mm.
Thank you very much, Mike, for the call. To our audience here at the Art Museum, hi.
I'm Pete from Janesville, and I recall some 50-odd years ago, I encountered a travel book by a gentleman named Richard Halliburton.
Yes.
And how astonished I was many years later to discover that, in fact, the man had never actually been out of this country.
Oh, my.
And I'm wondering, with the current technology, it must be even easier to do books that way. Have you been able to vet the things that you're choosing to see if the people have actually been to the places they're describing?
You know, I have not. That's an interesting question. I'm just assuming that what they're writing about, and I did include Halliburton in here without your little bit of information, though. I think that what I'm always interested in is the experience we have reading the book. And I'm a child of the 60s, where the new criticism was coming in, where what was important was the text itself and not the author. So I actually have a collection of poetry that came out early in 1960s, which did not give the title of the poem or the author of the poem. So if somebody can make up a great history, if somebody can write a great historical novel, whether or not, or a great novel about a different place, whether or not they've been there, that wouldn't bother me as long as I enjoyed it. I was going to say, when the first gentleman was asking the question about Poe and about Rome, there's a whole section on Rome in there too. And one of the things that one of the best ways to learn Roman history is a series, again, of mysteries. And I do read other things besides mysteries. But a series of mysteries by Stephen Saylor, S-A-Y-L-O-R. When you read those, when I read all of those as they were coming out, I felt like I could get a master's degree in Roman history. And it would be so little trouble. It would just be reading these fun books. And then Lindsay Davis has another series of Roman mysteries. And then there's a book called Ancient Rome on 60 Denaries a Day, which I think would go along with that other one.
You had a follow-up?
I had one other thing I wanted to mention. I'm reading currently a book by an Irishman named Ian MacDonald called The Dervish House, which, as far as I can tell, presents an excellent pen portrait of the older parts of Istanbul. I've never been there, so I can't be sure, but I would recommend it. It's a science fiction, but it's not bug-eyed monsters. It's nanotechnology.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Thank you. Thank you so much.
And Ian MacDonald is a great science fiction writer, a contemporary science fiction writer, so he's not doing the BUMs, the bug-eyed monsters. And I want to say, if you want to try science fiction or you want to try fantasy, the best way to figure out, sometimes you're looking at the books on the shelf and you don't know whether it's really science fiction or really fantasy. Well, somebody once said, and so I've adopted it as my own, is if it has rivets on the cover, then it's science fiction. And if it has foliage, then it's fantasy.
Thank you, Nancy. Over here, hi.
Hi, I'm Joan from Milwaukee, and I've gone through 5 or 6 very difficult years, and I would say, in this order, what has saved my life is Wisconsin Public Radio, my library, because of things I've heard on the radio, and the art of Milwaukee. The artists of Milwaukee, I can't afford to come here very often, but I can drive through Milwaukee and look at the architecture or stop at a little gallery, or just read the newspaper about the art scene in Milwaukee. You would like it.
Yeah, I told them to convince you. You're in the perfect place today then, aren't you?
Yes.
We've put them all together for you. That's great.
Yes. And for going to Washington, I would recommend the biography of Thomas Paine, whose author I don't know, but I got it because of something I heard on probably Kathleen's program.
Right, we had a show on Thomas Paine.
And it shows what a diversity and the arguments and my goodness.
And when the show is over, you'll get some little-known information about how that show came to be. Just talk to Rhonda, because
okay.
It's a great story.
Okay.
Okay?
I want to know how come it is that we're talking about book lust for travelers and dreamers when Ian Fraser is coming here on Sunday to talk, I think, about a book about Russia.
Yeah.
His On the Res and Great Plains were absolutely wonderful, and I hate it that I can't go and hear him free at the Milwaukee Public Library on Sunday afternoon at 2, but he is a great travel writer. I even read a fishing book by him.
Yeah, Ian Fraser's a wonderful writer, and his new book, In Siberia, I was lucky enough to get an advanced copy of it and read it, and so included it in Book Lust to Go. And it's the kind of book that when you're reading it, you want to have a little notebook because you'll want to write down all these little facts that he sticks in there, and like who's buried, what Americans are buried in the walls of the Kremlin, that kind of thing. And he's such a wonderful writer. This is a thick book, but I think it's one of the books about Siberia.
We are going to take more phone calls. We have a full bank of phone lines coming in, and if any of you at our audience here at the Milwaukee Art Museum would like to step up to a microphone and talk about books with Nancy, we'd love to hear from you. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, and this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Broadcasting live from the Milwaukee Art Museum and having a wonderful time with our live audience. We're going to go to a phone call now. Craig is calling from Minneapolis. Hi, Craig.
How are you?
Fine. How are you?
Doing very well. Hello, Nancy.
Hello, Craig.
Hey, one of the things, I always had a problem of deciding what I was going to read next, and it dawned on me that I thought I would start reading as a list of books, the winners of the Pulitzer Prize since the year I was born, which was 1957. And what's interesting about that is 1957 doesn't seem that long ago, but those early books, people were just talking about getting cars and the transition from cars and horses. It's an interesting thing to watch how the narrative in fiction starts to change over that period of time.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think that's a great, a really interesting sort of way of deciding what to read next, because the Pulitzers are such a revered institution. And I have to say that I, as a Pulitzer judge for fiction, 2 years ago when Olive Kitteridge won.
Exciting. Oh,
yes.
That's great.
That was, it was a wonderful committee, and we were just in agreement, totally in agreement. So it wasn't, there's a lot of committees, book committees, where there's a lot of Sturm und Drang among the committee members and nastiness and things like that. We had nothing like that. But Olive Kitteridge is so different from, say, McKinley Cantor's Andersonville, which was a Pulitzer Prize winner in the 1950s and long out of print and now back into print. And then last year's winner, The Tinkers by Paul Harding, is different from Olive Kitteridge again. So it's a way of in some ways it's a way of taking a kind of sticking your finger into the zeitgeist, I guess, about what each book is going to deal with and what our concerns are. And that, for example, every generation writes a Vietnam, at least one Vietnam War novel. And so this year's big Vietnam War novels, I think, this generation's are Carl Marlanti's novel Matterhorn, which, oh, you have to have him on.
Okay.
He lives in Washington,
okay.
But you need to have him on. He was a second lieutenant in Vietnam. He was in country. He started writing this book 34 years ago. It was just published earlier this year, and it's an amazing visceral novel about the war. On the other hand, there's another great Vietnam War novel that I just want to get in quickly. It's a first novel by a woman named Tatiana Soli, and it's called The Lotus Eaters. And the main character is very loosely based on the famous woman photojournalist Dickie Chappelle. But in the book, the main character goes to Vietnam because her brother has been killed there, and she wants to find out a little more about the circumstances of his death. And the book opens on the day that the U.S. is abandoning South Vietnam. And I know many of us watched that on television, and the helicopters and the South Vietnamese trying desperately to get away from the country. And then it goes back 10 years and shows how this woman became, how it developed to this final picture that she is involved in. And this is a book, I think, that gives us a picture of Vietnam from a woman's perspective. You know, not a combat soldier, but somebody who was with the soldiers taking pictures. And those of you who know the name Dickie Chappelle and remember Life magazine will remember her photographs. Those were her photos. Featured prominently in those big news magazines of the day. And in Greek mythology, the lotus eaters were people who were probably eating the seeds of like an opium-type plant. And so they were all mellowed out and, you know, oh, anything's fine, that's fine. What does Ulysses care? He's been gone from poor Penelope for all those years. But, you know, life is great. But in the lotus eaters, what those photographers are addicted to is the adrenaline of danger. And how this young writer in her first novel manages to give us that is remarkable.
Oh, that sounds really good.
It is. And it isn't getting nearly enough recognition.
Okay. And tell me just a little more before we go to the audience about the experience of being on the Pulitzer Committee. Do you take it as a heavy responsibility? I would imagine.
I think it's a big prize
to give someone.
It is a big prize to give someone, and it makes a difference in their life. For the rest of their lives,
right. They
will be a Pulitzer winner. And it's different from the other award committees because the Pulitzer has three judges, and we make a recommendation of three books that we do not rank in order. We write a justification for each book, and then it goes to the Pulitzer Board at Columbia University, and they pick, of those three, what book they think. Now, that's why when you go back and you Google a list of Pulitzer winners, some years it will say no award given, and that's because the committee overruled what the judge's recommendations were. So that was, I mean, I always felt, oh, I don't want to be, don't let that happen to me. But, you know, we were all three. One of the other judges was a book editor of the New Orleans Times Picayune, and the other was a professor emeritus at the University at Hollins College of Creative Writing and a writer himself. So it was, so every Sunday we would just sit down and say, this is what I've been reading this week. This book is coming up higher in my list, and this book is. And it was just great.
I would imagine. What an experience to have. From the audience, hi.
Hi, thank you, Kathleen and Nancy, for this wonderful show. I was wondering, I belong to a book club, I'm sure many of you do, and two of the books that come to mind is that we read The Help, and greatly enjoyed, and also some of Alexander McCall Smith's books, but both of them were then put on CD, and it just added such a richness to the stories, as Chapter a Day does. Right. I was wondering, how do they choose what books are chosen to be read?
to be put on tape, to be made into CDs or audio books.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. In general, I think that most books these days are coming out on CD, are being made into audiobooks, because what the publishers have found is that many, many, many people, many more than anybody thought, listen to books. I still say books on tape, but they're, you know, audiobooks. And you can download from your library, from your public library. You can sit at home, pick a book that you want to listen to, and download it on your MP3 player or your iPod. And, I mean, that's a wonderful, just a wonderful service that we have. I bicycle, and I bicycle early in the morning, and so there aren't a lot of cars and there aren't a lot of other bicyclists. So I feel pretty safe listening to my book on tape. I'm listening to my iPod with my book on it, even though I'm bicycling, and I know it's not a good thing to do. But I find, I don't know, and I'm sure many of you are audiobook listeners, but I find that it's, for me, it's easier to guess who the murderer was when you're listening to it than when you're, than, because I never can guess when I'm reading.
Oh, Nancy. I've heard, for some reason, I have a hard time wanting to read the help. I guess I've heard it's really good, though, from so many people now that I feel that I should. But the book that struck me on race was the interview we had with, what's her name, Isabel
Wilkerson. Oh, Isabel
Wilkerson. The Warmth of Other Suns.
Oh, yeah.
There's a book. There is a beautiful book about the epic story of America's Great Migration, centering on three people, and it is... It's big and it's good. It's really good, I think.
So it's Isabel Wilkerson's Warmth of Other Suns, and it's about the migration north. And it gives you, I mean, another period I think that we don't know a lot about, because I don't think it was covered a lot in textbooks, is the Reconstruction period and what followed that. Mm-hmm. You know, we read up to the Civil War, and then we sort of jump to the middle of the 20th century, and that period is what Isabel Wilkerson is a fabulous speaker,
and, oh, is
and
she?
Yes, and just
yeah,
a great,
it's a very good
great,
book.
great book.
So, what do you think of the help, the audience? Yes, have you? No, how many yes? How many no? Oh, see, look at that. That's interesting. And Nancy, have you? You've read it? I'm sure.
I did read it.
Well, I fall somewhere
in between. I enjoyed it. I think it's a really good book for a book group, because I think it raises a lot of issues that might be uncomfortable to talk about in other situations. From my just sort of personal sense, the characters weren't they weren't as well individuated as I would like them to be.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And but that's because I read for character. Character is the thing I like.
All right. Nancy, thank you. This hour just zoomed on by. I know. We have to say goodbye. I know. Thank you, everybody, for being here. Nancy, what a treat to have you in our audience. Thank you so much. It was a great hour. Broadcasting live from the beautiful Milwaukee Art Museum, Nancy Pearl with us in person, and she will stay after to sign books. We told you that if you pledge, the books will be here, and she will be happy to do that, and you can chat more with her about books. We have a number of people to thank. Nancy Pearl, of course, Lori Winters, who's the director of exhibitions for the Milwaukee Art Museum. And we'd also like to thank Vicki Scharfberg from the Milwaukee Art Museum. From our staff, Lisa Nalbandian, Camilla Simon, Brad Kohlberg, Rhonda Fanning, of course, and Chrissy Peace. You hear their names all the time. You want to wave over there so people can have a chance to talk to you. Thanks for all of your work. Cheryl Gasser. And we had a number of Wisconsin Public Radio volunteers with us, too. Claire Holland, Leroy Kolachinski, Susan Geltz, Thomas Tate, Liz Taylor, Sarah Grotenroth, Penny McCandless, and Elaine Reese. And we thank all of them for being with us. Well, that'll do it. And remember, you should write to Lori and tell her we want to do that 6 a.m. in the morning in that hallway. Oh, and then we need poetry, Nancy. We should read poetry maybe that day.
Or bring my daughter in who does that kind of site-specific theater.
She does?
Mm-hmm.
You have a daughter who does that?
Yes.
Doesn't
yes.
everything sometimes work out perfectly?
And she did a wonderful show in Minneapolis with the Stone Arch Bridge.
Hey.
So she's very, very into place.
We'll sign her up. Thanks, everybody. Thank you for being with us. Boy, that just zoomed on by.
I know.
Thanks, Nancy.
Oh, no. It's my
thank you. Great. Thank you.
Well, that's fine.
Is that all right?
Of course.